What's up, y'all? I'm Will here with Schedule Fly, and this is the Restaurant Owners Uncorked podcast, one of the highest rated hospitality podcasts in the world, brought to you by us at Schedule Fly. We provide a very simple web-based restaurant employee scheduling software backed by legendary customer service. If you're on pencil and paper or Excel, or you're on some software with tons of bells and whistles and features you don't need or use, Schedulefly is the perfect place for you. Easy to use, point, click, and go, and we'll take great care of you. Schedulefly.com, free trial, check it out. Also, this podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Pop Menu and The Giving Kitchen and Kickfin, and you're going to hear about them in just a minute. First of all, let's talk about today's guest. Hey, what's up, y'all? This was a fun opportunity. This is Savneet Singh. He's a CEO of PAR. This is probably the biggest company that we've had a CEO from. It is the biggest company we've had a CEO. Come on here, share his vision for his business. He's been there about 5 or 6 years. Before Savneet came in, this company has been around a long time, had a lot of problems, and was sort of on a slow but steady and very foreseeable decline. He's come in, he has turned this around, changed their culture, changed their vision, changed their strategy, and they are thriving, and this is an awesome conversation. You're going to learn a lot. Great talk, great opportunity, and great episode. So thank you all for listening. More episodes coming soon. See ya. Give your team the gift of Pop Menu AI Answering, a simple solution for phones ringing off the hook. AI Answering handles calls 24/7, 365 days a year, so your staff can focus on in-person guests. Customize your greetings and responses, answer common questions, promote specials and events, and send follow-up links to ordering and reservations. AI Answering handles it all while escalating more complex conversations back to your team. Never miss another tasty revenue opportunity. Pop Menu, the marketing technology platform designed to make growing your restaurant easy. Discover more AI restaurant tools that turn your to-do list into an already done list by requesting a demo today. For a limited time, get $100 off your first month, plus lock in one unchanging monthly rate at popmenu.com. Go now to get $100 off your first month at popmenu.com. Be sure to tell them that Will from Restaurant Owners Uncorked podcast and Schedule Fly sent you. Y'all, this is a great business. I just told you what they like me to say. I will say that we have a lot of mutual customers at Schedule Fly with Pop Menu. They all agree. Great product, great customer service, great results. Check them out, popmenu.com. This episode is also brought to you by The Giving Kitchen. Giving Kitchen provides emergency assistance for food service workers through financial support in a network of community resources. Since its inception in 2013, Giving Kitchen has served over 15,000 food service workers and awarded over $10.5 million to food service workers in crisis. If you or someone you know is a food service worker in crisis, please ask for help. TheGivingKitchen.org, and again, that's TheGivingKitchen.org. Y'all, this is a phenomenal organization. Jen, the founder, has been on this podcast. Jen Heidinger Kendrick, check out that episode to hear their full story. But if you know somebody or you need help, go to thegivingkitchen.org. Incredible, incredible organization and very responsive and has a wonderful mission. Check them out. Y'all, we are recording, and this is quite a cool opportunity for me. We've done this podcast for over a decade now. We've done over 500 episodes. Most of those have been with restaurant owners over the last year or two. I've had the opportunity to speak with some CEOs of some restaurant tech companies, but certainly not one as big and with as such an incredible story of late as PAR. So Savneet, thank you for taking the time to do this. I got a lot I want to ask you about today. Just take one moment and introduce yourself real quick, if you would.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having myself and I guess PAR on the podcast. Let's see. I've been running PAR for call it 5.5, 6 years. We are a provider of restaurant technology. I call it to the enterprise community, but really it's emerging brands and that want all the way up to the largest brands in the world, like Burger King. So you'll see us in from anywhere from Sweetgreen all the way up to a Burger King. Our products span all the way from the back office, POS and payments, to the front of house, loyalty and online ordering. And we've been working on this journey of what we call unified commerce, but it's this idea of trying to connect more of the disparate parts of the restaurant technology ecosystem to make your job as an operator easier. Because I think our foundational belief is that there is way too much restaurant technology out there today. And even though you need it all, having too many solutions sometimes has the opposite effect in that you might not be getting exactly what you hoped because you actually have created more complexity. And so, I challenge every restaurant operator to sort of show me that you've got clean data between your POS, online ordering, loyalty, back office. Like you don't, because nobody does. And our goal is how to help you clean that up.
Yeah, well, that is an understatement. The size of the tech stacks, if you as you call it, as you may call it, with so many operators is hard to imagine. You know, it's been really interesting, Savneet, because we started with, I mean, we're just, you know, we just do scheduling and communication. We started this in 2007, and there was like no restaurant tech. I mean, like most people were on pencil and paper or Excel or whatever for scheduling, and it was like just getting people to move off of that. And then in the last decade, the amount of money that has washed into this space has been staggering. And I get it. It's like free money kind of, right? For, you know, interest rates were zero. And, but there's, you know, there's, I don't know, whatever, 500 restaurant tech companies now that do all kinds of different things.
I
And I
think it's in
imagine
the 10,000. It's crazy.
it's nuts. And so I always think about, like, as an operator, what do you do? Like, how do you figure, okay, I want to solve for this issue. Well, there's 400 different companies that do that. It's overwhelming. And I feel for the operators that are having to sort of sift through all that noise amongst trying to run a business, amongst trying to, you know, manage every other part of their life and their business. So very challenging. Now, you came in 2019, if I remember correctly.
18.
PAR was okay, and PAR was not in super great place when you took the helm. And you have this is what I want to really dive into. You've grown a lot through accretive M&A, lots of acquisitions. But why did you get dialed in with PAR in the first place? What were you doing? You
Oh,
were loosely involved, but not as a
no,
CEO. So
no.
tell me the story.
Yeah, it's a circuitous path. I had originally seen PAR in 2017. I was running an investment firm at the time, and before that, I was running a tech company. So my background's kind of had this mix of operating businesses and then investing in businesses. And I reached out to the company, learned a little bit about it. Was very excited by the software product we now sell called Brink, which is point of sale software. And the company wasn't too interested in talking to me. I had sort of explored the idea of said, "Hey, would you ever want to sell me that software product you have?" PAR has this kind of amazing history. It's been around for 60 years almost. Originally, we were founded as a defense contractor to the Department of Defense. We basically did high tech Defense Department research on an Air Force base for 10 years. In 1978, we invented the point of sale terminal. In 1982, we went public off the success of McDonald's using that point of sale terminal, and then lots of other restaurant chains kind of going from there. We did really great, call it in the early mid 80s, but then the next 25, 30 years, we really had a tough journey. We got stuck primarily as a hardware and services company and not a software business. And then in 2014, we bought a software product called Brink. The idea for Brink was, PAR had all these enterprise customers buying hardware and services, but not buying software. And so could we sell hardware, sorry, software to our hardware and services customers? And, I think what we realized then and it was that DNA of understanding the enterprise was super valuable, but the cross-sell didn't actually work that well. But we had great product market fit in that customers were buying our point of sale software very, very quickly. And so in 2018, the company reached out to me and said, "Hey, would you have an interest in joining our board?" The company was going through some challenges. It had what's called an activist investor. It had some discontent, I think, on the management team. And I got kind of curious because I said, "Well, I remember looking at the company and I thought point of sale, itself was kind of an interesting space to look in." And so I, spent some time and said, "All right, sure, I'd love to join the board and, be a director." And I think the board's idea at the time was, "Hey, let's get this young, 30-something-year-old that understands software to match our board's experience, which was primarily in defense contracting, or hardware and services." I got on the board, and I'd say Within a month or two, I guess I personally, but I think everyone ostensibly knew this, was that the company was in a lot of trouble. Even though we had this kind of sexy, fast-growing software product, the company was a mess. We had very little money, and so we were trying to bootstrap an enterprise software product, which is just a bad idea. These are big, heavy products where you, as the customer, need a lot of support, and so it's hard to do that with, when you don't have money. We had a really bad culture. Our employee NPS was literally negative 60 or something like that. Our customer NPS was right around that, so our customers weren't happy. Our employees weren't happy. We had an interim CEO who wasn't really running the company, who had a chief of staff that was kind of really running the company for them, who happened to have been the founder's daughter. So it was a really weird set of mix. And then we had this challenge that we were being investigated by the DOJ and the SEC for bribery and corruption. And oh, by the way, we had two activist hedge funds coming in trying to demand a sale of the company. And so it was really scary. And so I went to our CEO at the time and said, "Hey, would you mind if I just met the management team to see what's going on? Because I'm the new guy. I've never really been on a public board before. I want to just kind of get a feel like what's going on, because these things I'm getting seeing are really scary." And so I jumped in and met the management team, and I came back to the board, pretty aggressively, and said, "This is not a fixable situation. We should sell the company. It's hard to fix such a bad culture. Even though we got this fast-growing software product, it was probably 5 million revenue out of 175, and so it was a very small portion of the base." And then importantly, we had no vision, we had no culture, we had no sort of, you could see that things were going to go off the rails. The board didn't want to sell at the time, and so we went and tried to find a new CEO. We hired a recruiting firm to go find a CEO, and so we went out, found a couple of candidates, but nobody really wanted to take the job. And obviously, looking back, that makes sense now, because who would want to step into such a messy situation? So when I became the CEO, I was there explicitly to sell the company and nothing else. I was not coming in trying to run it. I wasn't trying to become an expert in restaurant technology. I was just trying to find a way for us to get out of this thing. And when I got in there, a few like things happened. The most important being that the CFO of the company at the time came to me on the first day and said, "Hey, I think we only got about 10 weeks of cash left." And I went,
Oh, come on, seriously?
"How is that possible? We're public, we're audited. Like, how can we not know that?" And I just remember it very, very clearly. I said, like, "This thing can't go bankrupt, because I'm the CEO, and then I'm going to be in court for like 2 years. Like, that's going to really suck." And so it was the scariest moment of my career. Ended up being the luckiest moment of my career, because then I went and said, "All right, like, I can solve this." And so it forced me to dive in. And so we were really lucky. We were able to jump in. Unfortunately, we had to lay off, 20, 25% of the workforce within 10 days, which, sucks. We were able to restructure our debt a little bit. We were able to kind of sell off one of our assets. Eventually, we were able to get some relief from the DOJ and SEC. And we got a lot of like lucky stuff right. Fast forward, the investment bankers weren't able to find someone to buy our company at the time. But they said, "Hey, like, Savneet, you've got a good reputation. It seems like you've kind of winning the hearts and minds of the employees. Do you want to take this challenge on?" And I, on a very personal basis, while I was running an investment firm, we were doing great, making lots of money and all that stuff, I was sort of missing running a business. I love getting in the weeds and trying to help customers, try to build teams, try to sort of leverage, try to be a leader if you can. And I sort of said, "You know what? Like, I think I can build this up, I'll build this." But that found what it was built upon was the idea that restaurants were being eaten by software. They just didn't realize it yet. And I really thought, hey, PAR could be that ally for the enterprise restaurant or the emerging enterprise restaurant. We were never going to be able to compete with Square or Toast and where they play, but we felt really convicted that nobody was going after that enterprise community, and we had the right product to go after that. And so literally back in, that was probably beginning of 2019, we were like, we need to unify what's happening in the restaurant today, because while the software is in the restaurant, it is creating so much complexity for you, the end operator, that you're not getting the value from that that you're spending that money on, and we can help do that. And so that's how I got into it. And then I got really, obsessed with restaurant technology, our customers, the restaurant industry. I listened to every single earnings call of every restaurant chain there exists. I started talking to every single restaurant tech company. I went to every conference, and within like a few months or 6 months, I think myself and the team said, "You know what? Like, we're going to win this thing, and we're going to go at it hard." And so we went to this crazy transformation of, 5.5 years ago, our revenues were probably $10 million, and today they're well over 200. Our total revenues are probably 400 or 500, and we feel really proud about it. But we've never really got kind of obsessed with what we've accomplished, it's always been like, oh my God, there's still all these problems and our customers are still unhappy.
All right, y'all, it is time for a little mid-episode break. We're going to talk about Kickfin. Thousands of restaurants, bars, and breweries use Kickfin to tip out their employees instantly. No cash required. With Kickfin, tips go directly to your employees' bank of choice the second their shift ends. It's a really simple solution to a really big problem because if you're still paying out credit card tips in cash, it's costing you. Time-consuming bank runs and cash counting take managers away from work that matters. Cash is hard to track, which leads to accounting headaches, and it creates the perfect opportunity for theft, human error, and compliance issues. Bottom line, there's never been an instant secure way to pay out tips until Kickfin. It's an easy-to-use software that sends real-time, cashless tip payouts straight to your employees' bank accounts, 24/7, 365. Kickfin gives managers hours back in their day, makes reporting a breeze, and protects your business from risk. Most importantly, employees love it. Restaurants can have Kickfin up and running overnight. Employees can enroll in seconds. No hardware, no contracts, no setup fees. Visit kickfin.com for a personalized demo. See how restaurants across the country are digitizing tips with Kickfin. All right, that's what they asked me to say, so I say it, and it tells the story very well, but I like to add this in. We referred a customer that we know and love very well, SupDogs, to Kickfin. SupDogs has been a customer for a super long time. Trust them very much with their opinion on these types of tools. They started using Kickfin. I asked Brett, the owner, recently how it's going. He said, Kickfin is perfect. It's going great. Exactly what we were hoping for. So there you go. Kickfin.com, y'all. Check them out. So let's wind some of this back. First of all, yeah, and the minute you get obsessed with what you've accomplished, you become what you experienced for 30 years there, right? I mean, I would imagine a lot of the challenges the company faced for three decades and all the problems that came with that were, you know, success that led to a little bit of apathy, not as aggressive. I mean, that stuff can happen easily to a successful business. Happens all the time. You came in. Okay, so let me ask you this, Savneet. The board, you went and said, we need to sell the company, and the board didn't want to sell. Why didn't the board want to sell the company when you recommended that initially?
You know, I think...
Just out of curiosity, because it seems like it was a total disaster. Like, lucky they didn't for you, but gosh, that was a challenging decision.
You know, I think there are a lot of things at play. One, our founder or co-founder at the time still owned, I think, 25% of the company, 30% of the company. And so I think he had a lot of influence on wanting to keep his baby running. And you know, his daughter worked in the business. And so I think there was a little bit of that. I think the other part is, you know, being on a board is a good gig. And I also think there's probably arrogance and hubris in all of us and that we think we can fix all the problems. You know, I don't know. I know that, like, and listen, I think it's unfair of me to say anybody did it for any selfish reasons. I think that, you know, when you've been sitting in a boardroom and you've had optimistic CEOs and people present to you for a long time, you think there's great optimism. And I just come as an objective party, and I remember thinking, wow, everyone here is a really nice or a really good person, but nobody is like aligned. I'll give you a funny story, but this really proved it to me. Whenever I meet management teams, I always make an effort to sort of ask everybody one question that's the same for everybody, so I can kind of compare answers. And I remember I did this with the PAR team, but I asked everybody, you know, what's the best job you've ever had? And nobody responded with my current job. And I thought that was crazy because I was on the compensation committee. So, like, I'm part of the team that helps, you know, give comp out. But it really showed me that, gosh, of the, you know, 12 top 12 people here, if nobody thinks their current job is their best job, like, we got something that's not working.
The good thing is, and this is why you're in the position you're in and why people can do what you've done, is you view that as an opportunity. You came in. I mean, dude, I hats off, because not only is the technology behind the culture, I mean, when you have a bad culture, that's really hard. So to come in and turn the culture, and I know this stuff plays off each other as the investments are made in the tech, then that makes the culture better, but it's still a bad culture is really hard to overcome and can bring down any size company when you have that many people that are not happy with what they're doing. So you have to lead people to believe in this new vision. no easy challenge. So you've done an amazing job. Talk about when you came in and said, okay, I've spent 6 months. I know that we can, I think we can do this. What was your main focus at that time? Was it, we got to fix the culture first, or is it, well, we got to go out and, you know, start fixing the technology, or is it both?
I think first and foremost was the culture. And I think culture can mean a lot to a lot of people, but it creates the sort of mechanisms for how you respond to challenge. And, you know, we at PAR, you know, early on said, you know, we don't want a page of 10 values. At the time I said, I want 3, now it's expanded to 4. But the reason I said that was, you know, when I would look at companies' values, like these amazing companies, I would always look at them and be like, yep, I can fit there. And then I see the next one, I'm like, yep, I make sense there. It's not like there are company values that people are going to say, oh, I don't fit. Like, how many of us are going to say, oh, one of their values is integrity. Like, that's not me. You know, like, and I always thought that values do a better job, not of attracting you, but also like scaring you away, or they should rather. And we wanted that, not because we wanted to be to scare you away, but we wanted to kind of bring the tribe of people that wanted to take on this really big challenge, because we were in acute pain. We were in a bad situation. And so we wanted people that wanted to run up the, you know, run to the blazing fire, not run away from it. And so we created a super intense set of values and said, like, if we get the right culture, we can figure out the problems. And so for me, I think, you know, the job of a leader, particularly one in transformation, is you've got to figure out the right strategy. You got to figure out, okay, like, hey, we're bleeding money. We're going to go bankrupt. We're customers are unhappy. Employees are unhappy. Like, you've got to create a plan and strategy. But the way you do that is by catalyzing the team to believe that your strategy is a strategy for all. And the way they do that is you make the plan theirs. And the way you make the plan theirs is by involving them in making that plan. And so I think that what we did was we kind of aligned on this plan we got as a leadership team. And then those leaders then were able to come through and own that plan if it's their plan. And then my job was just to keep listening, keep providing a lot of energy and hoping we execute on it. But to me, it was sort of like the culture, it was creating the plan, really obsessing over our culture back then. And then it's just being radically transparent about where we're hitting, where we're missing.
Transparency is huge, and you've clearly done that, and that's so important to everybody, so they trust you. What are the four values?
Our first value is speed. We give a tagline for every value. That one is we're the kind of people that don't wait for the elevator. Our second value is ownership. We look for owners, not renters. We want you to treat PAR like you own the car, not like you rent the car. Our third value is focus, which is, you know, our belief that 80-20 wins the day, in the sense that those few decisions you make that are really important trump doing the rest right. Like, when I have my to-do list for the day, like literally like right here, I circle like what are the two or three things that are going to really add value to PAR, and then I deprioritize everything else. And I think it's so hard to do that in technology, because you get 100 different product enhancement requests, and you got to figure out what do you want to get done and what do you want, what touches. But I think focus means so much. And the last one is winning together. And it's the idea that we want a win at PAR is if our employees win, our customers win, our shareholders win, and our community win. Everything's got to work in concert. And so, you know, as an example, if our stock doubles, but our employees don't win, like, that wasn't a fair trade. That wasn't good. If our customers win, but our company doesn't win, our employees don't win, or our shareholders don't win, that's not a win. We want everybody to win in concert with each other. And that really helps as we're selling different products across different organizations and this idea of how do we win together.
Well, winning together is, you know, I mean, particularly it aligns with number two, right? Because if you want people to treat this like an owner, they do need to benefit when you win, right? When the stock goes up, they should. That's how you, because that's always a big challenge, right? Like, if you own a business, it's, you know, whether it's a publicly traded company or a little bootstrap business like ours, you know, it's your baby, right? Yep. So it matters, and every minute of every day you think about it and you care about it, and then you tell people treat it like it's yours, and then you treat them like they're just an employee, then that doesn't align. So getting all that stuff lined up and executing on that, again, you know, challenging thing to do and do well, particularly with a company of your size. So I always felt like, you know, the mission statements and value statements, I mean, I started out, got out of college, worked at a bank. I won't say which one, but I memorized the 8 mission statements. And when we had to all speak about something in my group, and I spoke, I was all bought in, like totally, you know, 24, 25 years old, like totally bought in and naive. And I remember this guy was like probably my age now, I'm 49. He was like, dude, like, why are you bothering with that? Nobody, it's just what they say. I was like, what do you mean? And you know, now I get it, right? Like there's so many companies that sit around and, you know, they come out with this mission statement and this is what we believe. And it's just like words on a wall. And people see that instantly, right? Like it's, if like they read through that very fast. Some execute it really well and it really is baked into it. And that's when culture becomes king, right? Because you can build a great culture where people are bought in because it is real and you are radically transparent and you're honest and clear with people and you lead by example, then that stuff gets really ingrained in the DNA of the business. So really good job, Savni, of taking, I mean, doing that in a short period of time is hard. And I know that's not like you just perfected it and everything's perfect, but I mean, like from where y'all were to where you've come, it's very impressive because there was a lot of, like 33 decades of that is hard to turn around in a short period of time. You came in and then boom, COVID hits. I'm imagining that you looked at that as, okay, this is a challenge, but it's also like could be a great opportunity for us. And I'm assuming that's how you think. So,
I mean, the retrospective for sure, I think in the midst of it, it was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? You know, I think we went through that sort of dramatic experience that lots of people go through. Which was, oh my God, are we gonna, you know, be alive at the end of this or survive at the end of this as a company? And it was freaky. You know, I think we were, we had to do what everybody else did. We had to cut our employee base down. We had to issue a ton of credits to our team. We had to do all those precautions. But, you know, I think through the end of it, what we discovered, and I suspect that's like many people, I think we really did come out of it feeling like, man, we can take on anything now. I think it showed who we were. I think it showed who we weren't. And, you know, I still remember those days because there were so many things that kind of had to work out for us to survive that worked out that I always think about, oh man, like we were this close to, you know, to the edge, if you will. And so I'm sure, you know, not everybody, you know, thinks about that stuff as much as I do, but I remember that really being a pivotal moment in our survival. But you know, I think one of the things that I've kept from that is kind of have to always assume that's going to happen again. And I, you obviously don't hope for it, but you always want to be ready for those crazy moments. So we, I think, learned a lot. Like you said, I think our culture evolved, our culture grew, but also I think we're really obsessed with, you know, making sure that we can survive anything.
There's a book. I see a lot of books. Do you read a lot?
I do.
I'll see all your books, but you do?
I do, yeah.
There's a book I read about, I don't know, it's been at least a decade. It's called Deep Survival. I'd recommend it. It's going to align with the way you think, but it's still a neat example of this guy went out and he found all these people that had survived black swan events in nature, right? Like maybe you're on a fishing charter with your buddies and the weather's supposed to be fine and we're out, but we're 20 miles off sea and some squall comes in or a rogue wave and the boat capsizes and now like, oh crap. Like this went from like normal day out to life-changing event real fast and are we going to survive? And it was all these examples throughout history of people that have been through something like that. And what the author came to the conclusion, the people that survive these things are the people that when this happens, this thing that wasn't planned, that had a huge impact, you have two ways that you can look at this. One is, no, this isn't supposed to happen to me. I'm out fishing with my buddies. This kind of stuff doesn't happen to people like me. What do I do? And you panic. Or you go, okay, well, let's just turn this into an adventure because there's nothing we can do about it. So now we need to turn this into an adventure and a journey and like try to creatively figure out like how do we solve this problem. And when you have that mentality, you survive, right? Like literally survive. But metaphorically in business, I think it applies really well. And you know, it's something I thought a lot about when, you know, when COVID happened and then we were unfortunate. Lee went through a ransomware attack January 1st, 2022, which could have literally just, I mean, it brought us to our knees. We were down 12 days, but you know, I kept going back to, yeah, but like, we can't change that. Let's figure out how do we creatively work our way through this. And anyway, so Deep Survival's you may enjoy that if you like reading that kind of stuff. It's a good thing for your, it's a good, you know, it's a good book for team members to read and things like that, because I feel like that mindset is I've built it over years. Like I didn't always have that, but you learn through trial and error, through example, and through kind of programming your brain. Like bad things happen, okay, no problem. Like it's a problem, but let's turn it into an opportunity. And if you can just reframe everything into an opportunity, it just, you know, reality is neutral, right? Like, so you can decide how you're going to handle something. And you seem to really have that mindset dialed in well. Let me ask you this, Savneet. Okay. So there's so many restaurant point of sale companies, restaurant tech companies, but so many point of sale. You've talked about this a little bit, but like, tell me about the types of brands that, like, you've got to have a focus, right? Like, this is who our sort of perfect customer is. You're not for everybody. Nobody's for everybody. But who's, like, if you're sitting there and you meet somebody and they say, oh, I own restaurants, whatever, and you're in a hotel, like, what's your 30-second pitch for the type of customer that's, like, perfect for PAR?
It's really simple. We are the enterprise solution for emerging and large restaurant chains. Most of the restaurant technology industry is built around the amazing stuff that Toast and Square and people do to the individual restaurant around the corner, your favorite Italian restaurant. We surface on delivering technology to those brands that are either already gigantic brands like a Burger King or a brand that wants to be emerging. And the way we do that is by giving you the most robust, first true cloud solution that exists in enterprise restaurants. And then we work incredibly hard to make sure that that technology is deeply integrated into your workflow so that you're not dealing with 10 different vendors, you're not dealing with 10 different reports. It tries to come off as if it's one solution. So that's our pitch. And I think if you're in the industry, you kind of get it because you're living this pain of like, why do I have 25 different reports to make a decision off of? Why do I have 5 different help desks? If you've got a franchise business, you know, you're thinking a lot about the experience of your franchisee or the manager that works for your franchisee. And we work to kind of help you feel comfortable that we can take that on.
Y'all have Big Chicken as a customer.
We do.
How long have they been? So they're as they grow, and I don't know how many locations they have now. I know they're growing like crazy, but they're deploying this across their footprint.
That's right. Yeah, we've had them probably, I'd say, a year or two. You know, it's been an amazing journey. They're a really awesome example of an organization that, you know, very early on realized that they wanted to be an enterprise brand. And so while they you know, they're not a big, large enterprise brand yet, I think what they, you know, identified for themselves was, hey, we're going to be one. And we want to have our technology stack ready now so that we're not fixing stuff up down the road, if that makes sense. And so they were, you know, really, really focused on delivering for their franchisees and for the corporate an experience that today could have been an enterprise solution. And so incredible, like, vision by them to think that far ahead. But I think also crazy smart because now they're not going to have to maybe do a big rip and replace once they start scaling. So they've been an amazing partner. I give them a ton of credit for being so forward looking and taking that initiative now, because most people wouldn't do that, right? Ripping out your point of sale, not a fun thing to do. Teaching people how to use different products, like, not a fun thing to do. But I've been super impressed by how they've been. You know, they took that step right now.
I'll tell you a quick story. I told you I was going to tell you this. So just briefly, Shaq is also, you know, DJ Diesel. And every year, a customer of ours in Greenville, North Carolina, called Sup Dogs, has this big party, big street party. 4,000 students show up. It's called Doggy Jams. And Shaq was their DJ 2 years ago. Couldn't do it last year because of conflict, but came back this year. And I was there, and I was with Brett, who owns Sup Dogs, and just kind of hanging out off to the side of the stage. And I was like, hey, if I stand up on the side of the stage, like at the stairs, can you get a picture with Shaq in the background? He's like, yeah, sure. So I stand up there, and I look over my shoulder. I'm like, I want to make sure that, like, you know, I'm not blocking Shaq, although, you know, he's huge. But he kind of looks at me, and he nods at me, and he winks, and he kind of, like, motions his head. And I'm like, does he want me to come over there? And I started to walk, and Brett's like, whoa, hold on, Will. Whoa, I don't know about that. And I look back at Shaq. He's like, dude, come over here. Come on. I mean, he's in the middle of like his set. He's DJing for 4,000 screaming college kids. I'm like, okay. So I walk over there and he turns and we look to the side of the stage and he's standing behind me and he, you know, we take a picture together and I
shook this
hand that was like, you know, the size of six of my hands. And oh, dude, it was just crazy. And he was so nice. I was like, dude, thank you. Because Yeah, man, that was fun. No problem, man. That was awesome. And I had on my Sup Dogs shirt. I think he thought I was a manager at Sup Dogs or something. And so he looks at the crowd. He goes, "Let's have another hand for Sup Dogs." And I was planted. Freaking. He was so nice, though. I have to say, when he walked in, he stopped. I mean, this is this giant dude, right? Like walking down the street. There's all these police all surrounding there, and he stopped every single police officer, looked him in the eyes, shook their hand, thanked them for their service. I mean, every single one, like to the point it took a long time for him to get up there on the stage because he went out of his way to make sure to do that. And I was like, man, what a classy dude.
That's yeah, really cool. You hear these stories all the time. And, you know, when we spend time with the Big Chicken leadership, you know, they all say the same thing. He really cares.
He does, man. I thought that was, it just happened Friday. So it was so top of mind. I put the picture up on my LinkedIn page, but so tell me about some brands that are small, but have that same mentality that they're going to grow. They're putting y'all in now. They're getting everything dialed in so they can just scale fast. Like some other ones that you're excited about.
Oh, there's so many. I mean, I think, you know, we've been with Cava Grill since they were super, super tiny. We've been with Mod Pizza since there were two stores. You know, today they're many hundreds. We've been with Sweetgreen since they were probably 10 or 15 stores. You know, we've been really lucky to kind of get into these chains when they're pretty early. And when I say lucky, it really was that I think, you know, when we were getting going, there weren't a lot of cloud solutions focused on the enterprise. Like I said, most of them were focused on, you know, that down market where you have a huge amount of opportunity. And so we try really hard to make sure, you know, upfront we tell them, hey, like, here's what you should expect. Here's why it's going to be different than what you use. And I think that what the great brands do is that they've got not just a 1-year plan, they've got a multi-year plan. And they're saying, well, listen, I know this is gonna be disruptive. I know it's gonna be a lot, you know, more money than I have, whatever it may be. But what I think they really are signing up for is like, what is the vision? Where are you gonna take me? And I think that's where this idea of what we call unified commerce gives them a lot of confidence that, you know, we know what we're doing and we're gonna help them get there. Because I think what they don't quite appreciate is that once you become a big enterprise brand or work your way to becoming a big enterprise brand, holy crap, does stuff get more complex. You know, just like business at scale, as you've got, like, I feel, you know, I remember when PAR was much, much smaller, I used to be like, oh man, when we're bigger, like, life's gonna be easy and I can just sit in my office and be like a, you know, fancy schmancy CEO. And man, what I've observed like now is like, as you get bigger, it gets more complex. There's more people you got to touch, more flights, more travel, whatever it may be. And restaurants are no different. And with your technology, it's like 10x. Because guess what? When you're 5 stores, your loyalty program is not the most important thing in the world to you. When you're 1,000, like, it's right up there. You know, when you're thinking about data, you know, when you're 2 stores, like, there are a few data points that you can collect that really matter. When you're 5,000 stores, like, it's, you know, it's not about having enough data, which data do you actually want to pick and who gets it? And so is that the data for the CFO is different than the data for marketing and so on and so forth. And so, you know, it's incredibly complex. And so we have been admired the brands I just mentioned are all great examples of people that made that investment because they had such great confidence that their model was going to work.
How many acquisitions have y'all had since you took over?
Let's see, probably 5.
So about 1 a year.
Yeah, about 1 a year.
Okay. Okay. Do you think I'm assuming that'll probably continue. Is that's.
You know, our learning with M&A is it's completely opportunistic. So, you know, we went 18, 20 months with that one, and then we just did 2 last month. You know, it's really hard to figure that out. But I would say if the desire to do M&A will be there because for us, M&A has been one of the better things we've done. And what I mean by that is I think we've created better employee outcomes, better customer outcomes, and better financial outcomes for our shareholders by doing M&A. You know, we're not a private equity company, and so we're not trying to buy, you know, dozens of different companies and slam them together and see what happens. We're going in there trying to make 1 + 1 = 3, try to unite and unite our culture and, you know, really and give our customers something that they couldn't get before if they had purchased these 2 products from different vendors. And so I think our learning has been that it's worked really well. So we probably shouldn't stop it. But at the same time, we want to be really prescriptive and directed about what we want to buy so that we're not, you know, just doing something because maybe the math works out.
Hmm. Gotcha. Okay. I want to respect your time. Anything we have not talked about that you wanted to talk about today?
The only thing I would say is one of the reasons we win that I, you know, every CEO is probably going to say this, but I think we probably believe it more than anybody else is, you know, culture wins. And what I mean by that, it's not just that we have these values and we obsess over them, we think about them, but it's how we show up. You know, we've won a couple of deals, really big deals recently, where that the CEO or CIO, when they make the call me and say, hey, you know, we're excited to let you won the deal or whatever. What they say to me is, listen, we really liked your products, but we loved your culture and your team showed up. And we love that we can text you, the CEO, at 2 a.m. and we're gonna get a response. But I also love that I can text, you know, the person on the support desk and I know they're gonna respond to me, and that intensity. And what I oftentimes like to say to our customers is, listen, this stuff's gonna break. Like, it's just going to. But you know, you want a vendor who's gonna be there and pick up the phone. And that's where I think we really stand out. And so we take it really serious. You know, we survived as a business for 40 years selling hardware and services. Like, let me tell you, that's a tough business. You are competing against people that will always find a way to find a country to make stuff cheaper. You'll find people constantly undercutting. But we survived because we treated the customers with tremendous respect, but we were owners. We lived their challenges. And so we tried our best, even though we've become a high growth company and we've grown, not to lose that heritage of, we're going to obsess over you, the customer. So it's a really big part of who we are. And I think if you talk to our customers, they'd say, like, that's probably the most unique part about us.
Well, amen. I mean, you're bringing together simplified tech for audiences that want to grow at scale, but it is a people business. Every business is a people business, but hospitality of any business in the world, it is a people business, and people want to have somebody they can talk to and that they trust and that cares about them when something goes awry. And that's, unfortunately, that's a low bar these days. I think it's a really low bar. I think that's unfortunate and fortunate. I think it's unfortunate that just it is, because we experience that as consumers in too many places. But I think it's fortunate for any business that's wise enough to say that's a low bar. And, you know, we can set a standard that's so much higher than that bar that it's hard for anybody to compete with that piece of it. And that stuff matters, man. I mean, it absolutely matters. It matters to, I mean, I've got 1,000 customers, you know, that we have that have been with us for over 10 years. And I mean, there's better option, or, you know, not better, more tech, this, that, and the other, new this, new that. But the loyalty part of that's huge, because they know that when, you know, I mean, they pick up the phone, they call. And like you said, like, this is my cell phone, you know, this nice little flip phone here, but my number is on our website. And if people call, they're going to get me and it's going to get solved. And that's a big reassurance to people, and it's rare. And to me and to all of us here, it's like, that's such an easy thing to do, but nobody else does it. So let's just keep doing it because it matters. So, well, dude, Savneet, I appreciate your time. I appreciate the conversation. I congratulate you. A lot of respect for what you've done there. And clearly you guys are going to keep growing and doing great things. So thank you for taking the time to come on here. I learned a lot, and I'm excited to, you know, keep following what y'all are doing.
Well, I appreciate you giving us the opportunity, and keep doing what you're doing. I think you're helping a lot of people.
All right, man. Thank you. Have a good one. See ya. Hey, y'all, before you dial out, just a quick request. If you are listening to this podcast on iTunes, if you would give us a star rating and a comment, it would be so helpful. If you're on Spotify, if you'd follow us or whatever platform you're on, if there's a rating or a follow, please do that. What that does is it tells these algorithms to put this content in front of more people that are looking for this type of content. So if you enjoy the episode, please do that. Thank you so much for listening to Restaurant Owners Uncorked or watching on YouTube. We appreciate you. We're proud to be able to do this, and we're just going to keep putting out great content, y'all. So stay tuned. Thank you.